This is ITE 1, Module 4. This is our preventative maintenance and troubleshooting module, for what it's worth. And you'll understand why I say that very shortly. Alright, I think that they've really gutted this particular section. So we're going to add a few things in because we have time, and we're going to do some review of how to clean and proper preventative maintenance tasks, because literally that section would take me about 30 seconds to read to you, and we're not going to do that. So, preventative maintenance is actually going and giving your computer a check once in a while to make sure that everything is working properly and to repair any faults that you might find before you have a real problem.
Is it worth mentioning there is no exam for this module?
Oh, yeah.
There is
no exam for this module.
Just so you know.
But you do have a worksheet. It is not in the curriculum. So if you're going to the Cisco site and somehow downloading all of your lectures from the curriculum, which I'm not sure you can even do, you have a specialized worksheet that I actually wrote up for you guys, and you'll be creating your own preventative maintenance plan. So you'll be writing down hardware and software tasks that you would do and when you do them, because it's a really good exercise to know how to write one, because you may end up writing one for an organization sometime. Any questions on that? Good. All right. So does anybody know somebody that is really, really cheap and they really don't want to actually go get their car looked at? They don't take it for the annual tune-up. And all of a sudden, they get really annoyed when that car completely breaks down, and they've got to spend lots of money to fix it, and they don't have their car for a while. And it just happens about the most inconvenient time for them. I'm sure everybody knows somebody like this, right?
Yeah. That's a good percentage of the population of Western Australia, unless they've got RAC coverage, which is when they just drive the car until it stops in the middle of the road and then call the RAC.
Is that like AAA, the American Automobile Association?
Yeah, that's basically what it is.
Ah.
So if they would have taken that car in and spent a little bit of money for that tune-up and gotten its oil changed and done all of that, their computer would still be working and they would have gotten to that meeting that they were supposed to get to and now are sitting in a tow truck shop and getting the damage assessed on their car for instead of being there. It's the same thing with computers. If we just leave our computers and expect them to run fine and run them into the ground and don't actually take care of them, they're not going to last us very long, and it's going to be very costly to repair them. So, doing some preventative maintenance actually saves us time and money, and we get to choose when the downtime is. That's one of the things that they really didn't talk about in this chapter that I always stressed. If you do the preventative maintenance, you get to decide when your computer's offline. You get to decide when your network's offline. You get to decide when your organization is going to actually have that downtime and make it at the most convenient time possible instead of 30 minutes before the big annual managers conference. Does that make sense? All right. So can anyone else think of any other benefits to doing preventative maintenance on a computer?
I suppose it would keep things running well, like fast and stuff. And
absolutely.
Avoid general clutter and problems and stuff.
Yeah, how many...
saves man hours?
It does.
It does.
I mean, how many people complain when their computer starts running slowly? I see it on my Twitter timeline almost daily.
See, I'm pretty good about the software maintenance, but it's the hardware stuff I don't really know how to do, and I should just get some help and open it up and do it, but I'm still a little scared.
Oh, you'll get it.
I like the people at work who have three or four antivirus programs running simultaneously.
Oh, that's a great way to do it. Of course, because if you run three or four of them, you're going to be doubly protected. You know, absolutely. Not.
She's
that's assuming that actually
sarcastic.
Works. That's assuming
it
that actually
doesn't.
Works. I had
it
problems
does.
Once
it
when
does.
My computer thought I tried to do that. You know, some of them just don't
and
like
you're
each
have
other
quarantine
at all.
Problems.
They think I'm a wizard because I remove two or three and they run fast.
That would do it, wouldn't it? Okay. So, any other benefits?
Alright. Prevents a person from spreading infected files as well.
Absolutely it does. You're not going to bring the whole network down with you because you have a badly maintained computer. Alright.
And then people don't want to be your friend when that happens.
No, no, they really don't. Alright, so, hardware tasks that you can do to complete preventative maintenance plans include cleaning. So, we're going to take, shut the computer down. We're going to take, unplug all of those external cables, and we're going to look at them and see if they are damaged, and have a look at the keyboard and mouse and make sure they are not damaged. If they aren't, all good. Just make sure all of the external stuff is not damaged. Then we can probably take a soft cloth and dust off the case, because, yeah, like the internet filter. We actually go and we dust off the case, because that case is really dusty, and we don't want all of that dust getting into the fans. Then you can open up the case. Go ahead. I don't either. Okay. Open up the case, and the best way to get dust out of the case and out of the fan grills is to use a can of compressed air, if you can get one, and that will blow all of the dust out of your case and make your fans much more efficient. You can take the RAM and video cards out and clean the contacts with isopropyl alcohol if that's something you want to do. Not something you really want to do that often unless you think that there's something really wrong with the cards or the RAM. And if you think that dust might have gotten in there. So that's not something... If in this case, the video cards, as long as they look like they're properly seated and are working fine, you probably don't want to take out and clean. Because they're doing just fine. Just have a look, have a feel, make sure they're seated, and you're all good there.
Taking them out and cleaning the contacts is important if you're in a dusty environment, especially if the dust has a high iron content, because iron conducts, and if you don't clean the connectors and stuff, eventually you will end up with shorts and smoke. So that's why they put it in there.
Okay. You want to make sure that the heatsink looks okay, it's not wobbling, everything's all screwed in and looks okay. And you can close up your case, and then you can clean up your keyboard and mouse. You can use a keyboard brush. Probably wouldn't recommend using a keyboard vacuum cleaner, because sometimes they will be a little too strong and rip all of the keys off of your keyboard. But a nice, long, soft brush will do. Same thing with the mouse. You can actually take it apart, or if it is a not a mouse with an actual ball in it, you just... I think you just actually wipe off the bottom of the cloth, isn't that about right?
Yeah, the famous lint-free cloth.
Yep. Alright, can anyone else think of any other hardware tasks that they might do to perform preventative maintenance on their computer?
I'd say not really relevant for us, but maybe cleaning your screens...
That's actually totally relevant for us. That is absolutely totally relevant to us. And we must, if we have screens, and if we have sighted people who will ever want to use those screens, remember to about once a month clean our screens. Go buy some screen cleaner wipes, or just take like a little bit of Windex. This is what I'll often do.
No. it can actually attack the plastic that makes up LCD screens. You might get away with it on a CRT.
I'm thinking CRT, that's what I use for my CRT.
Yeah, not a good idea on LCDs, and if it does get into the LCD, it does nasty things. I would tend to use a lint-free cloth to wipe the dust off, or a damp, very slightly damp lint-free cloth.
Yeah, but you don't want much of anything on these cloths when doing a screen, but you may need a little bit of damp, you know, water or some kind of screen cleaning solution.
The other point is that if you are partially sighted, it's very important to keep your screen clean, because sometimes you'll turn your computer on and you'll think you're having a bad vision day, when in fact your screen is covered in dust.
Do the swipe things work okay?
I think they do work fairly well. Grace is blowing her nose. They tend to work fairly well. They're a bit expensive. A lot of people...
I had one for my iPod. And it came with a little cloth. I still have it here, actually. It's sort of this really small, lint-free cloth that's really really nice, and I still have that, even though all the wipes are gone.
Bit like the glasses cloths you can get for cleaning your glasses. They tend to be lint-free.
Yeah, it is a lot like that, yeah.
Can I just say, too, just word of warning, I can't exactly remember where I heard this or what it was, but someone got this really cool little ornament with, like, a screen dusting cleaning thingy on it, and somehow they actually managed to damage an LCD screen with them, so I guess be careful of what you use.
Don't press, they might have pressed too hard. Don't press really hard when cleaning an LCD screen, they are delicate.
Because whilst the colours look cool when they go all bendy, then, you know, you don't want to do that for long term, because it will actually damage the screen.
I need to clean my monitor, actually.
Yep. So...
That's tricky. You can sometimes get CD cleaning discs and stuff, but I don't think they're recommended for computer drives. Generally, you have to take the whole CD-ROM drive apart, and given that the average CD drive is about $15, I'd probably buy another one. It is possible to clean them with certain things, but we don't talk about it in our course, because we are not... we are not considering that the average person will be cleaning their CD-ROM drive. We do have a couple of ex-course members who do take them apart and clean the lenses and things, but it's not for the faint of heart.
The CD, the discs work better in like a commercial CD player. They are fine for that.
Yeah.
But if you read your CD burner's manuals and stuff, it usually will say, "Do not use a lens cleaning disc on the CD burner." I don't know why. But that's what they say. So.
Different lasers?
I think it's the components aren't as sturdy in the CD-ROM drives. They're not designed to have those sorts of things in jammed into them. I think they're expecting the commercial, like, stereo CD players to get a bit more rougher treatment from people sort of throwing in the latest, you know, Britney Diva album.
And if it's in your car, then, yeah, you can definitely have... more wear and tear.
When Linda ordered some ink from Dell, they sold her a can of compressed air, a thing of swipes, and a little plastic pack thing. I didn't open it. It's supposed to be a cleaner for your laptop. I don't know what would have been in there, but they sent her air, compressed air, and some screen swipes. So I didn't want to goof them up if they didn't.
Now, the screen swipies are good if you've got them. If somebody gives you some screen swipies, they're absolutely fun to use.
Okay. You may have to use your ID to buy compressed air, depending on where you go to buy it.
Yes,
you buy
do.
It from Walmart, because people are using it to do naughty kind of getting high things. And so you may
really?
Have to
okay,
use your
then.
ID. I was really surprised, but...
There are actually some cases where you actually have to use compressed air in a well-ventilated area, because the propellant can cause you to get insufficient oxygen and die, and you don't tend to fix many more computers when that happens.
Is that technically known as getting high online?
Don't know.
Oh, Christ.
They'd be using air, you know?
Just running into the ground.
Okay.
Don't have that.
It's also a good idea to watch the angle of the compressed air when you're using it as well.
If you turn it upside down, it'll make ice if you spray it.
Really?
And none of us have ever done that, have we? Yeah, it becomes refrigerant. But none of us have ever done
I just heard about it.
It actually does.
Wow! Cool! Anyway. Oh, no. Okay. So any other preventative maintenance tasks? These are things you'll want to write down on your preventative maintenance plan for yourself. And do remember that preventative maintenance plans depend on the environment you're working in and the needs of the customer. So there's your hardware. One of the things
that I don't know if you missed it, and maybe you were going to go here, but one of the things they mention is that if you're working with an organization, preventative maintenance may have to happen late at night, on the weekend, off hours, so that's something to be aware of.
I didn't really go there. They didn't really go there. I talked about the convenience factor.
They went there last semester, so I thought I'd go there.
They did go there last semester, so yep, that's worth saying. So you might be the lucky person that gets to come in at 2 in the morning and do all these preventative maintenance tasks. I don't envy you.
If you're a night person that's sort of like me right now, that might work for you.
Yeah. Marshall, you were working on some preventative maintenance at your work, weren't you?
I'm not sure what you mean. I mean, I do handle software updates.
Yeah, you're doing all the software updates, and you said you did that once a year and stuff.
No. I do it once a month.
Okay, fair enough.
To make sure all our machines get patched, because our machines are data acquisition machines and they're almost never turned on unless they're actually running an experiment. So, you know, they'll go months without doing the software updates. And they get caught occasionally. Like we had to last year, we upgraded from SP2 to SP3. And it took us about 3 months to get every other machine up to date.
Wow. Yep. It took a lot of time. Alright, so with that segue, we're going to go into software updates. You want to update the operating system and programs if they need updating, defragment the hard drive, update and run virus and spyware programs, and that's basically what they're saying here. Anyone else have any other... you know what? I'd probably run disk cleanup as well. Get all of the unneeded, unwanted files off of the computer. Also, disk cleanup is not going to get everything, so why don't you once every 2 or 3 months have a little file audit, see what you need, see what you don't need, and reorganize your computer. It will take 20-30 minutes if you do it every few months, and oh my gosh, you'll be able to find things so much faster.
The other two utilities we usually mention in this chapter are CCleaner and MyDefrag. Go look them up. If they blow your computer up, that's your problem. Be aware that CCleaner will wipe out your cookies by default. So if you really did forget the password to whoobijube.com, then that cookie will be blown away and you'll have to go through the tedious password reset procedure, which just goes to prove you shouldn't keep all of your favorite passwords remembered in your browser and in your password histories. You should get KeePass password safe or similar.
Yeah, always look at what these programs want to do by default, because what they want and what you want are not always the same thing.
It may not be. It may think it's looking out for your best interest, but let's just say Avast. You know, when you install Avast, it messes up your network shares, and also make sure, well, at least in previous versions, that you can never do any kind of network sharing again. So, if you want, you don't want it to do that,
The other one with Avast, and if you actually sit down and read the license agreement, it's actually an extended trial. So it's basically free and extended trial, and they can tear it out from under you at any point. And in fact, they can say they'll do it remotely too. So do pay attention to those license agreements before you think Avast is a really good bit of kit.
That's basically it.
Also not really easy to uninstall either.
Yeah, you've got to uninstall it in safe mode, which is just tedious.
I think they fixed that in the.
I think they fixed that. I think they had to do that because accessibility people were having a good freak out on them. I'm not sure if they fixed it, but
nope,
I haven't heard
the same.
Anything about. Oh, fabulous! Very accessible, guys.
Does anybody remember when AVG threatened to pull their free offering off the market and how all the, 320 million we can't afford any virus protection people went insane at them because they weren't going to be able to have their freebie virus protection anymore?
Yeah.
No, I don't remember, but I could tell you with Avast, they specifically asked me why I'm no longer interested in their product. I wrote them a nice long, several paragraph explanation and told them all about not being able to see and how much of a pain it is to actually uninstall their software.
Yeah, I've tried to actually disable their software on a computer last week. Could not get it to do it. And I'm saying, this is your new accessibility features, guys? Wow, I don't even want to think about what the old version was like.
Yeah, it is a weird interface. I had a look at that as well, and I just went, what? I personally blame the operator, though, because I've never really gone into the program and don't know anything about it, at least from my perspective, so, yeah.
The other point is probably the easiest way to disable Avast is to get yourself a really nice new virus that'll shut down the antivirus software for you. It'll be easier than doing it through the interface.
Oh.
God, it might be. That thing's awful, I'm sorry. I'm just looking at it and I'm just like, wow. So yeah, no, I don't know what it was like before. Don't really want to know what it was like before, but if that's accessible, well, I don't know what to say about that.
The other thing to point out is that another thing to point out to your clients and customers and stuff is that the subscriptions to antivirus are usually paid on a yearly basis. So a lot of people will go and get, whatever antivirus program, and they'll pay $89.95 or whatever for it, and then they'll be confused when it wants to charge them $30 in a year's time to upgrade the subscription. So it's worth warning people that this is how the antivirus companies keep money coming in. It is actually a yearly or monthly or 6-monthly or 3-monthly, depending on how they do it, subscription. And it's quite expensive. Like, I think for some of them, I think it was like $40 or $50 for a 2-year subscription to AVG, the paid version again. It was just like,
Per computer.
Yeah, per computer.
$32 was $60 a year for 2 PCs. So yeah, they're not cheap
either. Yeah.
Norton's quite expensive now too, isn't it?
Oh, Norton's absolutely expensive and bloated.
The new version of Norton runs very well. 2010 apparently has just thrown salt in the other 5 versions that didn't work, and apparently it's insanely good and performs really well and doesn't bog your system down at all, which shocked PC Magazine incredibly.
Basically, yeah.
Have you ever used it, Kerry?
Get real? No way. I'm just saying what the magazines have said.
Fair enough.
Yeah, no, I don't think I would put that on my computer.
The other one that's quite cheap and for some people pure evil and for some people they love it is Vipper antivirus. Some people love it and run it with no problems at all, and other people, including yours truly, run it and it bogs down JAWS after 2 or 3 hours and all the eloquence speech breaks up until you reboot the system under JAWS 10 and Windows. So
yeah.
Keep that in
Windows
mind.
Windows 7 and JAWS 11, really no problems. It has a very... It's integrated spyware, antivirus, and firewall. The firewall can block things that you don't want it to. You have to go add exceptions. It's at least accessible, and you can do that now. But it is... I think it's like $60 a year for all the PCs in your house.
$70 for all the home PCs you own. I think so.
For a year. So that's actually a really good deal. Including your laptop.
So yeah, we've got like four computers here. So I'm thinking about doing that and getting my dad out of this ABG free thing he's
hell. ABG free is actually an alright virus software, but
it misses a lot of things actually, and in fact the paid versions have far more newer definitions and stuff. I've actually seen AVG miss about 30 different Trojans and stuff in the past, and you put on a competitor's product and it goes and picks up all the stuff that AVG didn't find. So it's good enough, but it doesn't have any of the surf shield and stuff in the free edition, and that's dangerous.
The other thing about Viper I wanted to There's say is that it has it
Avira for free if you're looking for free stuff.
Yeah. But we've already talked about it.
I only know one person who uses Avira, which is a separate thing. And if I find out that other people besides him like it, I'll try it. But he's the only person I know who uses it and absolutely swears by it. And I'm saying, you're the only person I know who
used it and I liked it,
has anything good.
It actually looked into System Restore, which I thought was really neat. I don't know how many other antiviruses look for viruses that are stored in System
Restore.
Yeah,
they
do. Yeah, most of them do.
That's cool. Oh, okay.
They do now. Even AVG does it.
Yep.
I just had my roommate telling me that, what was it, Panda Internet Security is in another league from everything else, and that all of the multi-million dollar corporations use it.
What is? Oh,
Panda.
Yeah, okay.
Panda.
Panda?
Yeah, it's out there, too.
What is... I've never
Panda
heard of it.
Panda antivirus has been out there. No, it's been out there for years. I mean...
Yeah, no, it's been
it's
around.
Not as well
it's
known,
okay.
But it's
it.
Been around. Yeah.
I'm just reporting.
It's a bit like VET. VET has been out there for years, too, but you guys probably wouldn't have heard of VET because it's the Australian antivirus by Down Under Software.
Oh, that name is so fantastic.
Yeah, another F-Prot. Really good one?
F-Protect is out okay. there, too.
Yep.
I don't know if it's any good anymore.
Another
MSC's
really good one.
It's still very cyclical. Like, it's not
MSC,
always the same.
Which one's
like,
that
a few
one?
Years ago, F-Protect was awesome. And then, you know, everything comes around.
Oh, okay.
Microsoft Security Essentials is what he's talking about.
Oh, okay, yeah. That's also another free option. Another one that's actually really good for especially Windows users is Nod32.
It works well with JAWS, too.
There is actually a classic interface that works with JAWS as well. If you flick Nod back into classic interface, it becomes much more accessible. The other one that's worth mentioning is there's also ClamWin, which is the free one that is actually the ClamAV from Linux ported over to Windows. And there's also a Mac version of that if you really are allergic to paying for stuff.
Yes, there is ClamXAV. I actually do have the Mac version, and people look at me like I'm insane, but it's like, I don't want to give my Windows friends viruses, okay? Even if they're supposedly aren't.
Yeah. Okay. Marshall, go ahead.
Remember that some of these free things are free for homes and not necessarily free for companies.
That's actually a really good point. And if you buy a home license for an antivirus like the Viper, it's only for home PCs or small or home office PCs. It's not for your company. You get in really big trouble.
AVG, have you guys actually read the AVG web page? It is for use on one computer in a home environment. Nobody pays any attention to that, do they? No.
No, yeah, the blind school I went to was using the free version of ABG on all four of their computers, and I, you know, felt like mentioning to them that they were breaking the law, but, you know, didn't.
Especially because if they're a charity, they can actually get an exemption for the actual, you can actually get, like, exemptions
for
charities.
Yeah, they'll give it to them.
Yeah, this is getting to be a big deal at universities,
sure,
though, because they're, Oregon got fined something like $100,000 for software piracy at one point.
Yep, so be careful if you're working in an organization that you have dotted your I's and crossed your T's on your licensing.
It is a problem because we were looking for a free CD burning application to run here at the association, and we had a lot of trouble finding one because a lot of it says free for individuals and non-commercials and pay up if you're not.
Did you ever find anything?
I think they used a media player.
They used a media player to burn the books, which was probably a violation of its license terms too, but hey. Also, CD Record has a Windows port. You could probably use that. It's GPL. Or CDRDAO.
Since we're talking about this, it's I'd just like to reiterate what Carrie said, which is that I'm not to besmirch the honor of any of our fine Cavi students or people listening to this recording to insinuate that any of them would ever use software piracy, but do not use it on anything you install and if you're working for a company, because they audit that stuff and they will find out,
oh,
and when they find out, they will fire
you. Oh my goodness,
yes. The end.
There's this thing called audits and computer audits, and this happens. If anyone, for any reason, decides to have a look at the software on there and sees that those licenses are not quite legitimate, that company could be in serious trouble, and so will you be. So this is very important.
Yeah, the company does not want to be in trouble, so they will take, if they give the option of firing this guy for stealing it and then buying all the licenses back, they will do that without, you know,
You're done. And they might take you to court,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, and they will not, you cannot use them as a reference, because, yeah, it won't be a positive phone call if you get another job and they ask you, so why was this termination occurring? Oh, because I committed several felonies. Okay, we'll call you back Monday.
Basically.
Actually, a big one for that is actually... Sorry, I was just going to say the big one for that is where you've got things like student copies of Office that get dragged into work and used, because everybody buys the academic copy because it's actually cheaper. The license on an academic copy only covers you when you are actually studying or actually at school doing study or at university doing study. It is not a perpetual cheapy license for you to use Microsoft Office, so you can actually get into quite a lot of trouble by not licensing Office properly or similar academic products. Adobe tend to be fairly heavy on that too. If they find you're not studying and stuff, you should not be using the Adobe, the academic copies.
One other thing about preventative maintenance, sort of you forgot, is backups.
Oh, we're not. We're going to backups in a very short while here. But yes, you're right. I did forget about that in the preventative maintenance field, because we cover it in troubleshooting a whole lot here. But yeah, backups are definitely part of preventative maintenance, and data protection is absolutely essential for when doing preventative maintenance, because if anything does ever go wrong, you want to make sure you have a backup of all of your information and data so that your business does not go to its knees. So I guess, yes, that too would be part of your preventative maintenance. Thank you.
Thank you. C-Tool says it's 100% data safe.
All right. Well,
sorry, I really had to do this.
Go ahead.
Okay, I was going to say, really sorry to do this because of the garden paths that we've already gone down, but I was kind of hoping to go down my own one briefly beforehand. When you were talking about, file system audits and just general cleaning up and stuff, my uncle is a technician, and he was once doing stuff, someone in an organization was whinging that their computer was going very slow, and he went through and found this spreadsheet, which, what they'd done, firstly, instead of using a template with the logo on as part of the template, that actually put the JPEG of the logo on each page, and instead of using the little, and this is like a big, 60-page spreadsheet, and instead of using the 50-kilobyte version of the logo, they'd used the massive, 1 meg bloody high-res one. And then, when he deleted all those, there was the old company logo underneath it. He ended up with an 8-gig spreadsheet.
Oh, my goodness.
God. Holy crap.
And he went through, cleaned up this massive-ass spreadsheet, and it literally went from 8 gig down to about 350 kilobytes.
Oh
my God.
That is special. All right. So, let's get off the garden path. Any other things that you would want to do for software maintenance. Because next, we're going on to the...
Well, you can uninstall unneeded programs if you're really sure they're unneeded, and you have to be careful with that. If you're on someone else's computer, just because you might think certain pieces of software is crap, they might want...
Ah, yeah. Like in Credemail. I would uninstall that just by default.
yeah, Google... Things I uninstall by default are Google Toolbar, Google Chrome, Yahoo Toolbar, the Bing Toolbar. Oh, I think I got that on my computer. Toolbar. I think I'm going to have to rip that off. Ask Toolbar, AOL Instant Messenger, that's
like
something that has to go. Oh, yeah, I know.
And it's just some vision-impaired people use the Google Toolbar because it does actually give you a lot of nifty... nifty things you can do. I know somebody who honestly had a legitimate use for Google Desktop Search, and if you'd taken it off their computer,
really?
They would have been furious.
Mutant? Wow.
Map question.
Could I also suggest that it be a...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, could I also suggest, particularly with vision-impaired people, that could be a valid point when updating programs, like you said before as well, because personally I like a lot of my old versions of programs, and if someone came through and updated my, you know, I don't know, whatever the hell else that I've got that's working, I would be very, very miffed at
that. It shouldn't bother you because you've got current backups, haven't you, and you can restore the image of your system in seconds flat. Good. No, seriously,
okay,
you need backups.
But honestly, as technicians, we have to display common courtesy, and if we're doing backups or updating programs, especially on an organization, we need to talk to them and see what kind of repercussions doing these updates will have.
And also look at the repercussions that not updating will have, because often older versions have horrible security. I know some people, for example, who still swear by Winamp 2.9, and it's got some very serious problems.
How about Internet Explorer 6? Internet Explorer 6 is dead. They are no longer providing security updates for Internet Explorer 6. If you are running Internet Explorer 6, you are probably going to get hacked.
Yeah, but unfortunately, if you update Internet Explorer past version 6 and you're running a version of JAWS that is 7, you're not going to be able to use the internet, and that is a serious problem for some blind people.
Absolutely.
And if you don't have the SMS to take you past 7.1, you have a problem. And yes, while we could say that the solution is NVDA, it's something that a lot of people would feel very upset if you actually did mess up their Internet Explorer 6.
Louis had that happen where I think it was the library at the college updated IE7, and he didn't have the right version of JAWS, and I was absolutely furious. Absolutely furious.
Yeah.
When you say backups, are we talking about backing up the operating system and all the data? I'm not sure that I'm clear on
that. That depends on what you want to do. You probably should in an organization, but if it's you and it's your computer, you can do any kind of backups you want. You can just take your My Documents folder and any relevant data and back it up in whatever way you feel like you want to do.
It depends on how much you want to be able to restore. If you have the recovery disks for your computer and you can run the recovery disks through and then load on all your drivers and software in 2 hours, then go right ahead. Then again, you may want to take an image backup of your machine so that you can be up and running in 10 or 15 minutes. It just depends on what you need from your computing environment.
Is the image backup, is that in XP or not till later?
That's later.
And certain versions of the image backup don't work with certain versions of Windows. Say, for example, the lower versions of Home, to the same point, you can't do it to network drives and stuff. And you've also got to be careful with your image backups that the actual restore procedure is accessible to the vision impaired, or you have friendly sighted people to assist you.
So what does a visually impaired person use?
It depends on the vision impaired person. A lot of them use Image for Linux, which is a Linux version of your Image for Windows, Image for DOS suite by Terabyte Unlimited. Some use Ghost with custom batch files, and some don't do it at all.
Yeah, I think all they've ever backed up at work is just the My Documents file, data files and stuff.
Well, if you have... But that's kind of painful, accessibility.
Yeah, it depends on how you want to be able to restore and whether you've got the other disks to bring it back. They've probably got the operating system installed disks or an image up on the network that they can just dump straight back down onto the network. But that's not always the case, so it just depends on what your needs are.
Carol, you left the channel. Yeah. Okay, fair enough. Alright. So, yeah, no, it just depends on the organization and you. Alright. So we're going to move on to our wonderful and fun troubleshooting process. Hey guys, remember that troubleshooting process that we were so fond of last semester? We don't even have to think about it anymore. Because it's completely gone.
What? That's not fair.
Oh, it's not gone. It's not gone. Oh, no. It's just really
It's gone.
Different.
It's just changed.
It's just changed very much.
They have managed to make this troubleshooting process even more vague. And even more, interesting. Excellent. Oh, yeah. So we get a whole new troubleshooting process to learn. And I kind of think this is even more vague than the last one. And
One was good.
If you don't,
and just so you guys know, I have a friend who's helping me with the diagram descriptions, and you will see this in every module after this.
So the quicker we memorize it,
even he said, "Wow, these are pretty bad," and he's not even taking the course. Okay.
He will probably have the troubleshooting process memorized, like, today.
Yeah, if he's helping us do any more, yeah.
Yep. Okay, so here's the deal, guys.
Also,
once we've all pretty much...
listening to this, we love you, we love your courses, they're fantastic.
They are, they're great. The troubleshooting process, just not my favorite thing. Okay, but it is just a guide to troubleshooting. As you gain more experience, you will develop your own troubleshooting process. But for now, it's going to be on a lot of tests, and we're going to pound it into your head. And once we've memorized it, by chapter 7 or 8, once everybody's comfortable with it, I'll make you a deal. We won't go over it anymore. How's that? So, we'll talk about it today. We'll talk about it next week. We'll see how people go in naming the steps, and once people are pretty good and most of the class can name a step on command, we're just going to assume that you know it because you probably don't want to hear it every single week for the next whole semester. That sound good?
And if you're reading the text, you can skip over that review of the process, but it'll still tell you, like, what are common printer problems or, you know, laptop problems or stuff. So don't completely skip troubleshooting. If you don't want to review the process
look at the stuff at the end on the common problem
stuff. Look at the stuff at the end, yeah.
And that's what's really important. Okay, so troubleshooting is a logical approach that allows you to eliminate variables in a systematic order. It's about asking the right questions and testing the right hardware and examining the right data. It helps you understand the problem. This will help you form a proposed solution to try. As I said, it's a skill that you will refine over time. Each time you solve another problem, you will increase your troubleshooting skills by gaining more experience. You'll learn how and when to combine steps as well as skip steps to reach a solution quickly. Hey, you might even come up with your own troubleshooting process. It's a guideline that can be modified to fit your needs. Just a note that when this course refers to a customer, we're referring to anyone who needs technical assistance from you. All right, on to the troubleshooting steps. The first step is identify the problem, establish a theory of probable causes, determine an exact cause, implement a solution, verify solutions and full system functionality, and document your findings. And Miss Elise's favorite seventh step, invoice the customer, as we always have to say. So we're going to go through that again. The first step is identify the problem. Second step is establish a theory of probable causes. The third step is determine an exact cause. The fourth step is implement a solution. The fifth step is verify the problem verify the solution and full system functionality. And the sixth is document your findings.
We don't talk to the customer anymore?
No, well, we do, but it's just not a step anymore.
Well, let's face it, they're going to lie to us anyway.
No.
Basically, what they've done is they've made the troubleshooting procedure generic for every eventuality. So if you're fixing your own problems, you can use this troubleshooting. If you're fixing it for someone else, you can use this troubleshooting procedure. As we can see, the people who've done the previous troubleshooting are not fans of this, and that's fair enough. They've just made it generic to every troubleshooting situation on a computer.
In fact, not even computers. They have said in this chapter that they have made it generic to any workplace problem that you might have.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they did say that, didn't they? Lord.
Yeah, and I was just like, okay.
They turned computer repair into a lifestyle now, eh?
Basically, yes. All right. So, does anyone remember from last year the secret, unspoken step that we do before we do any troubleshooting?
We back
that isn't
up
in
data.
Yes, we back up data. It's
sure
not really a secret. It's just not
back.
Yes. Before you do any kind of troubleshooting, make sure the customer's data is backed up. We're going to verify the following with the customer: the date of the last backup, contents of the last backup, data integrity of the backup, availability of all backup media for data restore if the customer doesn't have one or cannot provide any of this information to you and you are not able to create a backup for them. You should ask the customer to sign a liability release form, because this form will allow you to not be liable if their data is corrupted or it is lost. So it needs to contain at least the following information: permission to work on the computer without a current backup available, release from liability if data is lost or corrupted, description of the work to be performed, sign it, put the date on it. There you go. And keep that safe. Give them a copy, give you a copy, and make sure it's on paper. You might want to actually scan it in and keep it in your electronic files as well. And there you go. If they're not willing to sign that waiver, you don't want the job, okay? Because they don't have a backup, and you could be in some serious trouble. Most organizations will actually keep backups of their computers. You'll have a daily, weekly, monthly backup. Just find out what the most recent one of those is. And we're going to talk about actually different kinds of backups, I believe, in Chapter 5. And we'll talk about incremental, differential, and full backups. And that'll be fun. But we're not going to do that today, because your organization should already have it on media that is accessible to you, either CDs, hard drives, tape drives, whatever the case may be. Or you need to make one yourself before starting the work. And you can charge them for that. So, there you go. Any questions on liability and backups? I agree with you, Carrie. No? Okay, good. So now we're going to jump into to the steps of the troubleshooting process. I think they seriously just took this right out of the old notes, because this is not actually a step of the troubleshooting process. I don't know why, but the first thing we're going to do, guys, is wet Drew. No?
Back up.
After backing up.
We're going to talk to the customer.
That's absolutely right. We are going to talk to the customer. And we are going to ask the customer what happened and what the problem
is. Well, first we're going to fortify ourselves with a shot of whiskey, and then we're going to talk to the customer.
Yeah, okay,
no,
you are. All right.
Yeah,
ask direct questions.
I have a unique way of dealing with people.
I think they're trying to put that as part of identifying the problem, because you have to find out from somebody what the problem is.
I guess so.
I guess that's,
but that's
their
not actually in this heading, which is really confusing me.
Oh, really? Oh, great.
I just kind of looked at that. Maybe I missed it, but there was no heading. It was just like, identify the steps of the troubleshooting process, and we have talked to the customer, and we have the, basically, talking to the customer stuff that we had last semester. So, okay. What we want to do is ask direct questions to the customer. Stuff like, what are you doing, or what were you doing when the problem occurred? What seems to be the error messages? Were there any error messages on screen? Things like that. Ask direct questions to gather information. And we're going to talk a little bit about conversation etiquette. So when you talk to the customer, you need to follow these guidelines. Ask direct questions automatically. Do not use industry jargon when talking to customers unless they are a very experienced customer and you are trying to make them feel important. But
I love
basically,
dealing with experienced customers. Because then you don't have to do half the work.
Oh, but they can be think they're experienced, but not be. That'll be fun. You'll get to play with that in Chapter 10. So, it might sound really cool to use computer jargon, and it might make you look good, but don't do it, because you're going to confuse people. Do not talk down to the customer. It's really a bad idea to be condescending when you're working with somebody, because it's just going to make them angry, and they already have a problem. These people are under a lot of stress, so it's a really bad idea to be condescending to them. And
if you've ever had a call like that, you'll know exactly what it's like, and I think we all probably have at some point.
And you just want to throw that customer service rep against the wall.
I was only condescending to the woman when I worked at for tech support that insisted that I call her doctor. I figured that rated a bit of karma.
Oh my god. Okay. Do not insult the customer. You know what? We know people that are idiots and cannot do anything right on the computer.
Yeah.
Some of these people are dumb. But we can't tell them that.
It's
10:54. Okay.
What do I do, says the customer, when Jaws has just told her no windows in focus and exactly how to fix the problem?
So we have to be nice to them. Yep. ID10T, idiot. Do not accuse the customer.
They're paying you. You know, you don't want to pay someone who's going to then take your money and call you stupid. It's just not nice.
Basically.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right, but it's just sometimes it's very, very, very hard to avoid.
It's hard. Do not accuse
log
the customer
on,
of causing the problem.
Portable instant messenger and complain to your friends behind their...
Absolutely. That's why customer service people go down to the pub so often. Do not accuse the customer of causing the problem. You did it, and you broke it. I'm telling you, I'm giving you guys fair warning. If you seriously say that during our roleplay, you will be subsequently laughed at, okay? You broke it, and you did it. Not such a good look. So,
and
there
it's
you
happened.
Go. It has
yes,
happened before.
You will get laughed.
So don't do it. If you do, we'll laugh,
okay,
and we'll try and help you fix
you
it.
You screwed up, you idiot.
Up. Basically.
Yeah, not good tech before.
No. By communicating effectively, you'll be able to get the most relevant information about the problem from the customer. If you can keep them calm, or relatively calm, and build a rapport with them, you're going to get the best information out of them. Alright, we're going to talk about open-ended questions and close-ended questions. Open-ended questions are questions allowing them to give you information and describe things to you. They'll explain the details of the problems in their own words. So, some open-ended questions can be, what were you doing when the problem occurred? What actually seems to be the problem with the computer? What programs were open when this problem occurred? let's see. I'm sorry, my Twitter just told me. Has anybody changed anything on the computer recently? Have any updates been performed on the computer? These are all open-ended questions. So after you have asked the open-ended questions, you are able to proceed to the closed-ended questions, which are generally questions that require a yes or no answer. such as, okay, so, was your computer working yesterday? Has anyone else been actually using your computer? Do you know if your virus software is up to date? Questions like that. And this allows you to get the most relevant information in the shortest amount of time. So when you're working with a customer, listen to everything they have to say and take notes. Write down anything that you think might be important for another technician or yourself. Often the small details can lead to the solutions to a difficult or complicated problem, or change a problem from being, if you don't write down the details, a problem that could be simple might become difficult because you just didn't realize that one tiny little detail that customer said to you. Okay, next we verify the customer's description by, oh my gosh, gathering data from the computer. And I think we're actually going to stop here because it is about 10:55. And next week we're actually going to go in. No, 10:59. We're actually going to go in, and we've got a whole bunch of these tools, and we'll do a little bit of an interactive session and have a look at some of these tools, such as Event Viewer and Device Manager. How does that sound?
Cool.
Always nice.
Yeah,
I've never seen Event Viewer before.
Yeah, me neither. I had not actually used it that much.
I saw where it was, but I didn't bother looking.
Especially if you're a network engineer.
Yep. So we'll do an Explorer-style lecture next week. Do a little bit of playing with this. We're almost done with the troubleshooting process. We'll go into Module 5. And that's where we'll leave it. I was going to get through all of Module 4 today, but didn't. Sorry about that. But we've got plenty of time, and we'll just keep going. And for all of those of you who have tons of labs to do, enjoy the time to catch up.
Yeah, please do them for your own benefit.
Yes.
Please. And actually, most of what we talked about, though, was relevant, so I'm...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's okay that... It's certainly a little better than
yesterday. Oh, yeah, yesterday we went everywhere. But, yeah. No, we did actually really stay on topic this time, so good for us.
If you'd like
I think that's what we're gonna
do. If you'd like to look at a different troubleshooting process that might be more helpful to you after you've taken the course, and so that you don't, mix it up with the one that
completely
you're
learning
mix right
it
now,
up.
Go back to Module 4 of last semester.
Yeah, that troubleshooting
really
process I find is much more relevant.
It's easier.
I think someone commented. What does that sound like, a moth around a light bulb?
Huh?
Yeah, I hear.
Oh, the thing
I
that's going.
Like a
I think it's
like
Bryce's microphone wobbling
like
or something.
Something.
Yeah, it's been doing that all day. It's been like flapping. It's quite strange.
Oh.
Yeah, I heard you comment earlier, Luke, but it just kept.
Do you compulsively bounce your foot up
Sorry?
And down? I thought that might be.
No, I don't.
Because I know some people do, and...
Sorry, what did you say to me, Paul?
I thought I heard you comment about the butterfly or the flapping earlier, and then I kept hearing it, and I thought, well, surely others heard you comment on it.
I don't believe I commented on that, did I?
It's just our new thing to put one strange noise on each lecture, just to see how many people we can see are paying attention.
That might be fun, actually.
Fair enough.
Will that be in the test?
No, I'll come up with the next one.
No, it won't be in the test.
Although that would be a participation mark. So
it would be.